Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club.
Hello, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Linda Calhoun, Chair of the Club's International Relations Member-Led Forum. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now I would like to introduce our distinguished program speakers, Dr. Julia Moreno, PhD, and Thomas O'Keefe, Esquire, who will discuss tonight's topic, What a Decline of Hegemony in the Americas Portends for the U.S. Globally. Dr. Moreno is an experienced educator, presenter, and commentator. He has served as the Director for Latino Studies in the Americas, Executive Director of the Pan-American Society, and Faculty Director of the Privet Global Service Learning Program at the University of San Francisco. He is the recipient of distinguished awards that include Visiting Scholar Research Fellowships at the Library of Congress and the Institute for Historical Studies at the University of Texas in Austin. Both awards illustrate his research and expertise on globalization and American business, diplomacy, and culture abroad. Professor Moreno has authored articles and books, including Yankee, Don't Go Home, a book on Mexican nationalism and American business culture in Mexico. He is also co-author of Reflections, a 6-volume book series for elementary schools in California, and contributing author and co-editor of Beyond the Ego's Shadow, a book that looks at new interpretations of Latin America's Cold War. He's currently writing 2 books. One is on the history and evolution of Coca-Cola's corporate expansion abroad, and the other looks at the intersection of business and diplomacy in Latin America. Our next speaker is Thomas O'Keefe, Esquire. Thomas O'Keefe is the president of Mercosur Consulting Group, LTD. He is a graduate of Columbia University and Villanova University School of Law. He has a master's of philosophy in Latin American studies and specializing in history and economics from the University of Oxford. And he's a dual national of the United States and Chile. Mr. O'Keefe was chair of the Western Hemisphere Area Studies Program at the U.S. State Department's Foreign Service Institute from July 2011 until November 2015. He has previously taught courses at American University, Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies, the George Washington University Elliott School of International Affairs, the Villanova University School of Law, and he currently teaches at Stanford University. Please join me in welcoming our very distinguished speakers.
Thank you very much for that kind introduction. One thing I want to make crystal clear, sometimes people get a different impression from the title of the book that just came out last year that I wrote on the decline of U.S. hegemony in the Western Hemisphere. I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing. I think that the Obama administration in particular was moving to something else, more in the lines of a partnership. And I think that really is where the U.S. should be going in the future at some point. Although I don't necessarily think the administration we currently have in Washington, D.C. has a very clear idea about where it wants to go, not just in the Western Hemisphere, but in other parts of the world as well, too. The topic that I'm going to address tonight revolves around this issue of hegemony. And believe it or not, even though this is a word that comes from ancient Greek, the reality is what that exactly entails or means in English is contested. And a lot of it depends on where you fall on the political spectrum or what particular type of school of international relations you belong to. I'm not going to bore you with an overview of each and every definition according to the particular School of International Affairs, but I do want to hone in on most of these definitions. Agree that we're either dealing with the concept of domination or an alternative viewpoint would be leadership. And so what I'm going to be talking about tonight is focused on those two concepts. But before we do that, though, I also want to bring out that there is another interesting conception of hegemony. And it's one that's provided by Antonio Gramsci, who was an Italian philosopher, among other things. But he was also a Marxist. And his point of view was that hegemony was not something that was exercised by a particular country. Being a Marxist, his point of view was that it was actually something that was exercised by transnational or cross-border elites, economic elites. And that perhaps is the only concept that you I would argue you can say over the last two decades where you can make the argument that there really has been no decline in U.S. hegemony in the Western Hemisphere, because in point of fact, it's the capitalist, free market-oriented elite, whether they're American, Canadian, Argentine, Brazilian, they're all the same, and they're basically still at the top of the deck. In that sense, from his perspective, there has been no decline in hegemony. In the book, I look at four case studies in particular. One of them is what's been going on in the Inter-American system, which is manifested by the institution that most of you probably are familiar with, the Organization of American States, but there are others involved in that Inter-American system, the Pan-American Health Organization, for example. The Inter-American Defense Arrangements as well fall under the auspices of this Inter-American system. The other case study I look at is the Free Trade Area of the Americas, which some of you may recall in the 1990s was the centerpiece of U.S. foreign policy with the Western Hemisphere. We're going to create this giant free trade area stretching from Alaska all the way to Argentina and Chile in the south. And the third case that I examine is this initiative of the Obama administration very early on, the Energy and Climate Partnership of the Americas. And it was important. They actually originally had it for the Americas, but they decided to change the word for it to emphasize that, they really wanted everyone in the Western Hemisphere to be participating in this on an equal footing. They shouldn't expect that the United States was necessarily going to take the lead, and they certainly, the countries in the hemisphere, should not have expected the United States to foot the bill either, as traditionally had happened. And then the last case study that I look at to make the argument, at least using the traditional definitions of hegemony from the different schools of international relations is the rise of China, not just as a trade partner, but as a lender and also as an investor throughout Latin America and the Caribbean. It's important to point out, though, there are different impacts. The further south you go, the more pronounced Chinese investment, lending, and actually more of a two-way import-export relationship exists. And that's a little bit different the further north you go through Central America and Mexico. In terms of the Inter-American system, those of you who are familiar with how this organization or this whole system has developed over the last century and a quarter know that the United States was definitely always in control of the agenda. When the organization, the first organization that manifested the Inter-American system. The Pan-American Union was formed in 1910. For Latin America, the biggest concern was U.S. intervention, U.S. invasions, U.S. Economic influence. And throughout that entire first 20 years, despite all these efforts by the Latin Americans to put on the agenda the issue of intervention, you know, what they were trying to do was develop very strong legal prohibitions against the intervention in the internal and sovereign affairs of countries in the Americas, in the affairs of their neighbors. Despite the strenuous efforts of Latin America, it never made it onto the agenda, basically because the United States had the upper hand and basically decided what got in did not. Things shifted a bit in the 30s with the Good Neighbor Policy, but that had a lot to do with the fact that at that point, the administration of Franklin Delano Roosevelt could see that there were war clouds appearing on the horizon in Europe and Asia, and so it needed the not just the political support, but it needed the commodities that these countries in Latin America and the Caribbean had, and so therefore there was a shift. So finally, we did get the U.S. agreeing that there should not be interference in the internal affairs of another sovereign state in the Americas. After the Second World War, there's all this very strong language in the charter of the new Organization of American States that was created in 1948. But unfortunately, at least for the first 30 years, that was really not respected or honored. And the reason for it was because right after the Second World War, we also create this very extensive inter-American defense system as well, too. And that's used by the United States to get support from the rest of the hemisphere in its fight against the Soviet Union and communism. So whatever noble provisions may have been in the OAS charter against non-intervention, respect for human rights, that all the member states had to be functioning democracies, that was actually put in the background, and the real emphasis was on mutual defense. What we've seen in the last 15 to 20 years, I would argue, is another shift in which Latin America actually begins to get the upper hand. So there are things that are important for them, for example, that are now on the agenda, get voted on. One of them, for example, was the ability of Cuba, if it wanted to rejoin the OAS. It had been suspended after Castro came to power in the 60s. There was the whole issue of the war on drugs as well, which was very viewed very negatively in the hemisphere. They actually pushed a report to declare the U.S. war on drugs a complete failure. And it created a shift in the Obama administration as well, too. That rhetoric of the war on drugs after this report came out in 2013 was no longer used. And there are a number of other things that occurred within the inter-American system that underscore that the United States really isn't in control of the agenda anymore. More importantly, we have new organizations in the Western Hemisphere in which the United States is explicitly excluded. The UNASUR, the Union of South American Nations, the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States, that's underscoring the fact that these countries in Latin America no longer feel it's necessary to be involved in an organization whose primary purpose is to try to control U.S. intervention. They now feel free to basically create their own organizations and just completely keep the U.S. out if they want. So that's a very rough overview of what's been going on with the inter-American system. I'm not going to say very much about the Energy and Climate Partnership of the Americas. Unfortunately, that never went anywhere because we never got federal climate change legislation passed in Congress. So a lot of the things that were contemplated under that partnership were impossible to achieve. And then I want to address the issue of Latin America and China. As I said before, the further south you go, the stronger the relationship is, the stronger the Chinese trade relationship is, and the further north you go, closer to the U.S., less so. This is actually a chart, and I don't know what happened. I guess the numbers unfortunately disappeared when it was sent over the internet. But what you see there is basically this tremendous growth in importance of China as a trading partner for the countries of the Mercosur. So we're talking Argentina, Brazil, Paraguay, Uruguay. And you go from a situation in 1993 when the FTAA, the Free Trade of the Americas, was first proposed, where China is actually in this ranking behind trade within Latin America, trade with Europe, and trade with the United States. And by 2013, the Chinese now are the third most important export market for the Mercosur countries, right behind Europe, and even more importantly, trade within Latin America is actually more important for these countries in the southern part of South America. The U.S. now has been relegated to fourth place. You see something very similar in terms of where the imports come as well, too. And you contrast this with Mexico, where the red still represents the United States, as in the other graph. But here you can see the United States is by far the most important trading partner, and the Chinese, at least in terms of a destination for Mexican exports, is actually well behind the rest of Latin America, represented by the orange, and the European Union, represented by the green. It gets a little bit more interesting when we look at Mexican imports, because even though the Mexicans have had a very difficult time exporting to China, the Chinese actually have been much more successful. And that's initially was in direct competition with what Mexican companies produce for the Mexican market. But it's shifted over the years. A lot of those inputs or imports in general that are coming from China into Mexico today represent actually things that are used to make things in Mexico that are then exported to the U.S. So that's been an interesting development. If we just look quickly at lending to all of Latin America and the Caribbean, in 2016, the Chinese actually lent about 38%, so just under 40%, more than a third of the loans that countries in Latin America and the Caribbean obtain from multilateral institutions for things like economic development comes from Chinese development banks. The Inter-American Development Bank, which historically was the most important source of economic development financing in Latin America and the Caribbean, today is down to 19%. The U.S. Exim Bank, I throw in there, it facilitates U.S. Exports primarily. That's 28%, and the World Bank is now relegated to 15%. So, you know, as a group of lending agencies, China today is the most important for Latin America and the Caribbean. Investment, you see kind of similar patterns as well, too. From a situation 20 years ago where there was almost no Chinese investment in Latin America and the Caribbean, where in some countries today, the number one investor, new investor in the region, or number two, generally tends to be the Chinese. So you've seen a dramatic change there as well, too. Okay, all right. I'm not going to talk about the Energy and Climate Partnership of the Americas. There's a lot of other things that were covered in the book, too, that I won't talk about. If there's time, we can. So I want to hand it over to Julio. Thank you.
Thank you, Linda, for the invitation, and thank you for coming and for the opportunity to speak. My work in many ways deals with multiple layers of U.S.-Latin American relations, and my conversation today will center specifically on those different layers. And what I do in my work is I'm intrigued by looking at the intersection of U.S. business and diplomacy in Latin America and looking at the various levels of that relationship. And within, once we start scratching beneath the surface and we look at that complex relationship, we see that the economic part is one of multiple layers. In many ways, what I do in my work, I look at the relationship between the United States and Latin America, three different layers, so to speak. And I use the concept of Joseph Neyer's levels of powers or relationship across nations as an effort to get into that. And part of what it does is it gives me the opportunity to kind of evaluate at what points do economic interests trump, and I hate to use that term here, but trump political interests or other interests in the region. So it makes for a very complex analysis of what those relationships are like and how and why they evolve at various points. To try to quickly recap what I mean by it and how I use that concept to try to look at U.S.-Latin American relations, Neyer's work suggests that when we talk about hegemony or the power among nations, that often one of those layers consists of military power. Simple enough. But that upper level of military power also runs parallel or horizontal, so to speak, to the economic sphere and the type of negotiations and trade agreements that are often worked out at that mid-level, so to speak. But at the lower level, you have a much more dynamic level of interactions or transactions, so to speak, that often deal with cooperations of agreements, dealing with, say, immigration, climate change, so on and so forth. So my overview of U.S.-Latin American relations, to some extent, looks at the commercial element as one of a very vibrant relationship. If we try to look at this and map out the relationship between Latin America and the United States, it is clear that between 1945 and the 1990s, the driving force of U.S.-Latin American relations is the Cold War and the idea that Latin American nations need to unify with the United States against a common enemy, in quote-unquote communism. And in order, that relationship, to a large extent, it marks one of those periods where American hegemony, American influence in Latin America, at least in the nations that cooperated with the United States, seemed pretty significant. At the military level and at different levels. But that began to change because something happened after the 1990s, and that is that the United States, to some extent, withdrew quite a bit. As it withdrew from the Cold War, it became largely disengaged with Latin American events. And as a result of that disengagement, and it's not fair to say the U.S. was completely disengaged, the U.S. thought of very specific transnational interests with Latin America, mainly behind the banner of neoliberalism and economic cooperation, deregulation, free market economy, so on and so forth, as well as very specific interests, the war on drugs, for example. But among Latin Americans, that period was seen as a period of disengagement to a large extent. And from the 1990s to 2015 or so, what you see is, to some extent, Latin American nations jumping on board with some of those interests that coincided with the United States. Again, economic deregulation, free trade, so on and so forth, war on drugs. But in addition to that, you saw the development of a pretty significant bloc of Latin American nations that identify with the left and aim at providing a bloc against the United States, namely ALBA countries, right? Basically Cuba, Venezuela, Ecuador at that point, Bolivia. In addition to that, from the 1990s to 2015, more or less, as part of this movement to generate free markets and deregulation and economic growth, some Latin American nations move aggressively towards signing different free trade agreements, not just with the United States, but with other countries. And to some extent, throughout that period, China begins to become extremely influential in terms of some of the investment in Latin America. That movement, there was a number of agreements also signed with the European Union, so on and so forth. But that stage from the 1990s to 2015 and 2016 specifically begins to change, right? And it changed for a couple of reasons. One is a turn to the right in the southern part of Latin America. You see by 2015, Argentina, Brazil, Chile, and again, countries turn to the right. So ALBA begins to lose some of that clout. But in addition to that, by 2016, with the election of Donald Trump, you see, at least from the standpoint of Latin America, another layer of disengagement and outright hostility, you would argue, towards institutions that Latin Americans have actually embraced behind the banner of economic trade, so on and so forth. So I wanted to start out by recapping that because if we look at the question of how much has American influence declined after the Cold War, in the last 20, 30 years or so, you do see that decline is certainly present in the economic sphere. And if we look at looking at China as an example, and Tom already started talking about the increasing influence of China after the 1990s. And to some extent, I would argue that, make no mistake about it, Chinese influence, economic influence, and investments in Latin America is significant. But to some extent, I think often if we just look at American influence through Latin America, in Latin America, through that particular lens, I think that we run the risk of overestimating the impact of that decline. Because if we start scratching beneath the surface, we see that in other layers, that relationship between the United States and Latin America is actually pretty strong, in some areas more than others, of course. But why is it then that China seems to appear as this dominant, this giant that is just taking over, and the U.S. is basically, the U.S. influence is winding down? To some extent, the investments provide enough of an explanation for that. The United States, China, for example, replaced the United States as the largest investor in Brazil, in Peru. If we want to just look at Brazil alone, Brazil-Chinese trade was about $1 billion in 1993. That number increased to $76 billion by 2017. So the influence is certainly there within the economic layer, so to speak. But again, if we scratch beneath the surface, we see that there are actually some significant challenges that come along when we look at Chinese investments in Latin America. The first one is that a good number of those investments have been in the form of loans. Some of those loans, a large amount of them, 33% specifically, have gone to countries like Venezuela. So we're talking about what is the profit margin of some of those investments. Considering the political situation in Venezuela, again, we have to look more carefully here, but it would be hard to make the case that that's a good investment, at least in terms of returns in the short term. But on the other hand, a lot of the projects that have often been announced and cited as an example of Chinese influence in Latin America often have not materialized. The biggest one was the basically $50 billion investment in a 171-mile canal that China proposed to build across Nicaragua. That program basically has been abandoned to this point. And again, we could start looking at very specific examples, and we see that at the very least, that picture, that image that we saw of this giant China investing in Latin America is at the very least in going through some sort of pause, to put it bluntly. But there are other challenges, and Tom alluded to this, right? One of those challenges is that even in countries where that rank among the largest trading partners with China, such as Mexico, the economies really do not align. For example, Mexico in 2016 only exported about $5 billion of goods to China, and it imported $65 billion. So in terms of the trade deficit, it just doesn't, again, this is not to say this cannot work, or this. I'm not questioning increasing Chinese influence. What I'm asking is that, what I'm saying is that there's some serious challenges that need to work out even within the economic sphere, which is the most clearly, clear sphere in terms of trying to measure Chinese influence in Latin America. In other words, I guess what I'm trying to get at, as I note here, is that the different approaches that we develop to try to make sense of Chinese influence in Latin America and the decline of American influence abroad, and that one is that China is this giant that is rising and that is taking over, right? The other view that scholars have provided, Harold Tinkernow in 2014, for example, basically noted China's rise in Latin America has not impinged on core U.S. national security interests. That doesn't mean it will not lead to there, but I think I tend to identify with a more cautious approach about the increasing influence of China in Latin America. That is not shouldn't be surprising, so to speak. After all, U.S.-Latin American relations throughout the 20th century became very, very deeply ingrained at very different levels. It takes more than a decade to disentangle those type of relationships.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Hear thousands of our podcasts on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 500 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now, back to our program.
Now, I had a number of charts here that I'm actually just going to go through briefly because I want to make sure that we have enough time to have that conversation. But I'll be happy to engage in a more close look at Mexico, Chinese-Mexican relations and what that means in light of the United States. I'll be very brief in this explanation, but when it's all said and done, U.S.-Mexican trade is very, very deeply rooted, and disentangling that relationship at least in the near future, is next to impossible. Mexico is the third largest trading partner of the United States. The U.S.-Mexican economy seem to actually integrate and tap into each other pretty nicely. But we are trading over $4 billion a year with Mexico. By comparison, Mexico is trading about $65 billion or so, closer to 70 now, with China, and much of it is in imports from China. So again, I'll be happy to come back to a discussion in Mexico, but I wanted to also talk briefly about Brazil, because actually Brazil is one of those countries where Chinese investments had actually evolved quite a bit, and you've seen it's actually possible to trace the evolution of Chinese investments in Brazil, which began pretty much on the export of commodities from Brazil to China. That created a number of challenges for Brazil and other countries that relied on exports, such as Argentina. But essentially, that was the starting point of, I guess, Chinese Brazil investments. If you see, within the last few years, if you look at the chart on the upper right with the different colors, the chart on the lower right, what you see is that the type of investments that China is moving towards in Brazil is encompassing now other industries that are specifically targeting local Brazilian consumers. So in many ways, I guess what I'm trying to get at is that if we use Latin America-China relationships as a venue to evaluate the decline of American influence only in the commercial sector, then the challenge for China has to rest on essentially diversifying that type of investments in places like Brazil, on finding venues within the Mexican market that allow for economic trade that complement each other. But those are daunting. That's a daunting task for Latin American economies. And again, I'll be happy to come back to engage in specific discussions on these type of issues. So what do we make of those relationships? And again, I realize I focus specifically on China and the economic relations. They're kind of the mid layer there, so to speak. But essentially, if we look at the history of trade relations in Latin America with the rest of the world, I have no doubt that the challenges that China-Latin American relations face somehow will be worked out one way or another. As that trade relationship continues to grow, if we still stay within that mid-level, there is no doubt that the competitive environment for U.S. investments in Latin America will increase within the next decade, simply because as Chinese companies gain more ground in local markets, especially as Tom noted, in South America, that makes for a much more competitive environment. That, you could argue, could benefit Latin American consumers, could benefit China, but it does make it more difficult for U.S. investments in those regions. At the other levels, to again continue with the concluding remarks, militarily speaking, that power across the Western Hemisphere still remains pretty intact. The nation that has looked at imports of weapons from both Russia and to some extent China is Venezuela. But Venezuela has invested $5.6 billion in weapons from 2000 to 2017. Again, relatively small investments. The rest of Latin America, when it comes to weapons and military defense mechanisms, it's aligned with the United States. On the lower level, I think that is the area, that is the layer of U.S.-Latin American relations that had taken the biggest hit. And it's taken the biggest hit for the reasons I noted earlier, which is disengagement by the United States towards Latin America after the 1990s, but also that extra layer of what Latin Americans perceive as arrogance by the Trump administration has further damaged the type of relationship. I didn't want to include charts on public opinion of Latin Americans towards the United States. I did have a number of them. But what I did want to do, what I did want to end up with is, by way of conclusion, is to talk about what does the relationship of Latin America with the United States looks like today? And again, come back to our question, what's the decline of American influence in Latin America means for U.S. foreign policy in general? And as you look at the research polls by the Pew Research Center, despite the disengagement, despite the decline of public opinion towards towards the United States in Latin America, when asked whether it would be better for the world to have either the United States or China as the leading power, in Brazil specifically, which has the largest, huge Chinese investments, 51% voted for the United States, only 28% for China. Mexico was a bit more balanced. 48% noted they would rather have the United States leading the world, and 41% noted China. The rest, by the way, noted that they would rather have both. Argentina is a whole different ballgame. Argentina noted 35% noted China would be, the world would be better off having China leading the world. Only 33% noted the United States. On the right, and again, I'll be happy to come back to this point, but it's a public opinion poll by the Pew Research Center, extensive research actually, trying to capture public opinion worldwide. And again, I guess the concluding, to end this part of the presentation, there is no doubt that American influence has, at the very least, been challenged and declined. What we make of that relationship, how the United States, if its goal is to reclaim that relationship, that leadership in the world, so to speak, how we do that is really depends on, I'm assuming there's a lot, there will be a lot riding in the 2020 presidential election. Part of it starts at that level, but it also depends on what the corporate sector does and what type of economic dealing gets done or doesn't get done, and the mechanisms that are followed to get those economic trade agreements or economic relationships done. But most importantly, it's that goodwill, that public opinion, and the different organizations that provide, that have made for a very dynamic interaction between the United States and Latin America, both public and private in terms of the corporate sector, as well as individuals like you who develop an interest in Latin America. Again, thank you for coming to the event, and I look forward to the discussion.
Our thanks to Julio Moreno and Thomas O'Keefe for their comments here today. And I'm Linda Calhoun, and I'll be moderating today's audience question period. And we have a large number of questions, so we're going to go ahead and get started. Two of these questions that came from the audience spoke to China's relationship in Venezuela and given their investment, what does that look like today? And in the absence of U.S. hegemony, how should Latin America handle the current Venezuelan crisis? Can a unified group of Latin countries exert sufficient power over Maduro to staunch the bloodshed? So I'll let both of you decide if you'd like to comment on that two-part question.
Well, let me take a shot at this. Right now, I think it's the Latin American countries who are dictating what the response to Venezuela is. Especially in South America, they've all been inundated with refugees from Venezuela. There's some 3 million people that have left the country in the last 5 or 6 years. So this is a very pressing issue. And in particular, it's the Lima group of countries, which includes Brazil, Argentina, Chile, Peru, Colombia. Mexico is not involved, interestingly enough. And it also includes Canada. And they have been attempting to achieve a peaceful exit of Maduro. And there were lots of discussions that were going on months before the individual, the 35-year-old Guaido, who has declared himself the president in the absence of a legally recognized election in the country, and so to fill that void as the president of the National Assembly, declared himself the president. That's something that has been discussed in the works with this Lima group for many months. Despite the bluster you hear coming from Washington, D.C., all our options are on the table, implying that the U.S. is going to do what it traditionally did, send in the Marines, it's not going to happen. The reality is the United States is overextended, so it's not going to get itself involved in yet another quagmire. So I think what's going to happen is going to be something led by Latin America and Canada. So in that sense, things have changed. Unfortunately, we did have a regional organization, UNASUR, the Union of South American Nations, which in the last 5 or 6 years was attempting to reach a negotiated exit. But that organization has fallen on hard times, basically because Venezuela is a member, and all votes or any decisions that are taken in that organization require a consensus of everyone. And so because it was always impossible to get Venezuela to vote on things that affected it, that organization, unfortunately, especially in the past year, has fallen on very hard times. But I think if anything comes, it's going to come out of the Lima group.
And Tom and I have been friends for quite a while now. We don't always see eye to eye on some of these issues, which is great. It makes for great discussions. There's no doubt that Latin American nations have been involved, and there is no doubt, as you noted, Tom, that the refugee crisis, those 3 million refugees fleeing to other countries, has prompted some Latin America, South American countries to mobilize. There's also the fact that those countries, some of those countries, are now governed by right-wing governments. That, again, doesn't help in terms of South American-Venezuelan relationships. I'm also not convinced that the United States has not played a role, right? Marco Rubio, Senator Marco Rubio from Florida, has been very, very active. He was designated by Donald Trump to actually head this. Mike Pence has been extremely, extremely active, meeting with Guaido and broadcasting actually messages to the Venezuelan people and even singing the Venezuelan national anthem with Guaido just recently. So I'm not sure that the U.S. Hasn't mobilized, far from it. I actually think that what is ironic is that this is a clear contradiction within the Trump administration policy of America first and disengagement from other events. We're pulling out of other places. And in other places, actually, the Trump administration is advocating for, again, pulling back. What makes it surprising is that we're actually advocating for a different policy in Venezuela. I do think that the U.S. has been quite aggressive in Venezuela. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I just think that, again, Mike Pence and Marco Rubio have been very active. I think the resolution for Venezuela should have rested on different venues. We all know that the U.S. has many arsenals at its disposal when it comes to diplomacy. One of those arsenals, which we could have used a long time ago, was the fact that over 40% of the Venezuelan oil comes to the United States. We had other venues. We had other cards to play. We chose not to. And that goes. That is true for George W. Bush. George W. Bush tried to overthrow Hugo Chavez in the early 2000s. That didn't work. Then we disengaged. When we implemented financial economic sanctions, Obama kind of withdrew. I think that, I mean, we're not blameless when it comes to the situation that has been created in Venezuela. I'm not saying, again, that I'm advocating for Maduro or the opposition. What I'm saying is that when we look at the diplomatic game, I don't think we have done our best job of playing that diplomatic game. But that's, again, it's just my opinion.
Yeah, there's one other thing, too. There was a question raised about the Chinese role in Venezuela. I think it's very interesting that the Chinese basically, after 2016, have stopped lending and investing in Venezuela. And you know, I know there's a lot of concern about, you know, what role China could play or what role Russia could play in sustaining Maduro. But quite, you know, to be perfectly frank, I mean, I think that as long as Guaido assures the Chinese and the Russians that their investments will be respected and their loans will be paid to the extent the country is in an economic condition to do so, you know, they will accept that. So I don't see Russia and China playing a role in undermining any attempt to push Maduro out peacefully. And I think it's very interesting, too, that Maduro has not arrested Guaido in all this time. And that, to me, is an indication. There's lots of things that are going on behind the scenes, negotiations, talks, not just involve the U.S., but the Russians, the Chinese, and the rest of the Latin American countries as well, too. I think what Maduro is trying to find is a way to get out where he won't end up immediately being extradited to the U.S. So, you know, I think what is being talked about behind the scenes is coming up with some type of an amnesty. And you're right. I mean, the U.S. is interested, obviously, has particularly this administration, but I think the previous two, Bush and Obama, you know, in trying to get Maduro out. Or before that, Hugo Chavez as well, too. But I think that that it's a mistake to think that it's the U.S. that's in the driver's seat. I think in this case, it's actually Latin America that's making the push, and the U.S. is really going along. But anyway, that's my opinion.
Thank you. This next question, gentlemen, is much of Chinese trade policy seems to be driven by food security. Do you think this will allow or not allow a harmonious relationship with the U.S. in Latin America?
It's not just food security, it's energy security as well, too. And in that sense, I don't think there is... that's necessarily going to imply some sort of conflictive relationship between Latin America and the U.S. if they favor, for example, exports to China. I mean, the United States is an agricultural powerhouse. We export an incredible amount of food, a lot of it with subsidies, which has very detrimental impacts on other countries in the world. But we're increasingly self-sufficient in energy resources as well, too. So I don't necessarily think that those two areas where the Chinese have a very strong interest in Latin America are necessarily going to result in an inevitable conflict with the U.S.
No, I agree.
What role, if any, do non-governmental organizations, NGOs, nonprofits play in your multilateral or multi-layered framework?
They played a critical role, right? And I think that especially at a time when there is a good deal of disenchantment among Latin Americans, especially, again, the closer you get to the U.S. border, the more disenchantment there is, right? But if you look at... let me step back a little bit. Because there is such a great deal of disenchantment with the administration and with the policies that are often followed along the lines of immigration, for example, along the line the lines of often just very, well, there's no other way to say this, right? By idiotic language that is used to refer to Latin American countries, as you may recall by the President of the United States when referring to El Salvador or Haiti, for example. So that type of unnecessary, language, it's further enhancing that disenchantment, popular disenchantment that you see among Latin Americans. And I think to some extent, this is where these NGOs and other organizations come into play. And I think that that we do have a very important role to play at that level, because we do know that politicians come and go. But what I like to think is more constant is that type of substantive relationship that the people of the United States have developed with Latin America, whether it is through exchange programs, whether it is through NGOs, whether it is through humanitarian efforts carried out by different organizations. I think that especially these days when the rhetoric is so politically charged, the job of those organizations and any of your citizens, I think, is more important, more than ever, in many ways. Again, because the, as I noted, popular opinion, generally speaking, is favorable to the United States. There's no guarantee that will stay there, right? And how that goodwill, that positive popular opinion towards the United States, it's not the driving force of foreign policy or economic agreements, but it definitely helps. And I think maintaining that is extremely important.
Thank you. This next question speaks to, I think, the Chinese political influence. And do you see signs of that growing, and particularly in bodies like the United Nations, you know, in votes in the United Nations? How do you see growing Chinese political influence in Latin America?
Yeah, well, when you have a vote in the UN, for example, or the Human Rights Commission on the treatment of the Uyghurs in Western China, or the situation in Tibet. You know, in Latin America, if your number one trading partner, you know, your number one export market is China, if your number one lender now is China, if the Chinese are involved in, you know, a whole series of economic activities in your country, it makes it very difficult now to vote against the Chinese. And we have seen that already in the UN. The other thing, too, I think that's important to point out. It's true that under at least the government of Premier Hu Jintao, there definitely was an attitude in China to emphasize the fact that Chinese interests in Latin America were strictly commercial. And it was a way also of trying to downplay any concerns or fears that may have existed here in the U.S. about the Chinese getting too involved in a part of the world that we traditionally have seen, you know, our quote-unquote backyard. But things have changed with Xi Jinping. That he is very aggressive in terms of trying to make very clear that China is a world power, and it has the right to be in any part of the world that it wants to be. And when you look at some of the investments that the Chinese have been making, particularly in the last 4 or 5 years, in the telecommunications sector in particular, in which they are overhauling and updating the entire telecommunications sector of a country, companies like Huawei, all right, the same company that's been in the news here in the United States, you know, all this concern about that it's a way of allowing, you know, China to spy, to get access to information by these investments in the telecommunications sector. Well, guess what? I mean, Bolivia, for example, their entire telecommunications sector has been overhauled by the Chinese. It's a Hong Kong-based company that now controls the port services on both ends of the Panama Canal. So, you know, when you start seeing things like that, I think it's very naive to think that that's not going to have security repercussions for the U.S. in the future. I think, you know, the Hu Jintao period is over. We're in a new era now. And, you know, the U.S. really should be much more concerned than it has been up to now in terms of this increasing Chinese relationship, particularly with South America. Maybe it isn't the same in Central America, the Caribbean, or Mexico. But, it, you know, you can see the handwriting on the wall.
I think, Tom, it's probably one of the areas where I personally, at least my understanding of Latin America, I'm not ready to press the panic button yet. I do think that if we look at it, and perhaps this is because I am a historian and by training, and I think when you look at the broad picture, there is no doubt that that a commercial relationship is there. There's no doubt that the potential is there of using some of these industries to steer things, right? But I think that if we look at it strictly from a commercial, if we look at the entire foreign policy strictly through a commercial lens, I think we do run the risk of not giving enough weight to other layers that kind of shape foreign policy. This is not to say by any means that China is not increasing its influence. And this is not to say, I completely agree that the new Chinese government is much more assertive in terms of its foreign policy, no question about it. But I think when you look at the diplomatic circles, Latin America is largely aligned with the United States at various levels. It is different in South America, and I know you focus on South America. Generally, focus on North America, Central and North America, and the Caribbean. So I know that we're looking at different regions, but I do think that a lot of Chinese investments, a lot of Chinese focus, have continued to be on the economic sphere. Again, this is not to say they're ignoring these other places. This is not to say that in other parts of the world, China is not being more assertive in terms of establishing its foothold in global politics. But I do think that when you look at places like Mexico, when you look at Central America, And when you look at places, even like Colombia, for example, when it comes to policymaking, they're largely aligned with the United States. If you look at, and I didn't have some of this, but if you look at some of the public opinion polls on how China is perceived and how the United States is perceived, it seems to steer still on the side of the United States. Again, this is not to say that that won't change. But that's why I think that part of the challenge that we face as we move for the towards the next 5 to 10 years, right, is how do we, if we do care about cementing that relationship, maintaining that relationship with Latin America, because we do feel that it is the Western Hemisphere and it benefits us, then how do we cultivate that relationship in the next 5 to 10 years? I think that is a challenge because I'm not convinced that it won't go the other way. I'm not ready to press the panic button yet.
Well, gentlemen, that will be the last word. I would like to thank Dr. Julio Moreno, PhD, and Thomas O'Keefe, Esquire, for their comments here today. We also thank our audiences here, as well as those listening to the recording, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 115th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you.